Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Now, Fat Al's Tuna, that's a recipe. When I was a boy working as a busboy in the Shanks Paramount Hotel, I saw how tuna was really made. Fat Al was a 350-pounder. Now, when he made tuna in a tureen, he didn't use a mix master. He used his hairy forearm. He had his cigarette dangling from the right side of his mouth, and the kitchen was banging and bustling, and the people were out there eating a ninth meal of the afternoon. And he was mixing a tuna. He would throw the cans of tuna in. They'd throw in vats of mayonnaise. And the guy stirred it with his arm. He rolled up his undershirt. You see, you got to visualize this. Fat Al would lean over that tureen with the arm, the big, giant Italian arm, full of hair. And his arm was mayonnaise thick up to his armpit. And he's got the arm moving around. And he said, "You see, kid, you keep moving it till you get a nice creamy consistency." Meanwhile, the ash is falling off his cigarette. I guess that helped the taste of the tuna because the people never complained. They loved it. Now, that's a tuna. There is a proper tuna with a little sweat and arm hair. Now, that is a good tuna fish recipe. Other than that, I don't want to talk about recipes. Here's a story on the two faces of England that caught my eye. It said, Englishmen quayed up to denounce their country as being sick and depraved in an article in Der Spiegel. According to the German magazine, our island story is now filled with brawling drunks, overflowing prisons, truancy, late trains and racists, and our only heroes are philandering footballers. We have become a nation ill at ease with ourselves. It sounds like America. Now filled with brawling drunks, overflowing prisons, truancy, late trains and racists. The only thing missing from that list are phony liberals. Our only heroes are philandering footballers, so we could substitute philandering basketball players. We become a nation ill at ease with ourselves. Yet in the same week, a new guidebook paints Britain as an idyllic country where everything stops for afternoon tea, complete with cucumber sandwiches and crumpets, delicious fruitcakes and jam sponges. Everyone wears tweed in the country, and the trains generally run on time. The only problem with the English is they can't speak the language properly. That's the one problem with them. They never, like, kept up with the times. They speak a kind of a brittle, older language that's not really – doesn't really resemble the English that I know. And it doesn't work for them anymore. That's why they're shriveling as a nation. Can you name one British talk show host that sells in the world? No. People don't like – that British accent was hot in the 60s. Everyone hired, like, a chick who had a British accent because all the Jewish guys in the garment center got hot for that. You know what I mean? Yes, Mr. Katz is not here. They always hired him in the garment center. That's who they hired. But that's over with. No one won. Now they want like a Puerto Rican woman or Mexican. That's like, in a certain way, it's reverse déclassé. If you got someone who speaks that kind of parochial English, it's more appealing in a certain way, very in your face. No one wants that English thing. That's over. In the 60s, yes. Right through the late 50s, early 60s, the Twiggy, the Beatles, The Aston Martin, the whole thing was very cool. But then the English thing died with the breakdown of the nation with immigration, with the breakdown of because of the asylum and the liberalism and the whole thing. England is no more. I mean, they're just not what they were. So it's fine if you like it. I'm not knocking it. But the English accent does not play the same way that I enjoy listening to it. It's kind of archaic and cute in its own way. But it's not used in the same – how many people do you call up today in business and get that English girl accent? No one. No one anymore. I'm not putting it down. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that no one is into the English accent thing as cool. In fact, it has a reverse effect on people. I never forget when I was in graduate school, I had a professor I really admired a lot. Now, he was an American, PhD, a really fine chemist. He was the chairman of the pharmacology department, and I was doing graduate studies under him, and I love this guy. He'd come from a major American pharmaceutical firm and retired to teach pharmacology, and I really admired this guy, okay? And he spoke, he's not a New Yorker, but he spoke a regular Midwestern New York accent. I'll never forget, I was thinking of this just the other day while shaving. An English professor had come to meet him and talk about something, and the Englishman walked in and said something like, "Daryl Devonshire here." And he said, "I'm Frank, how are you?" In other words, he didn't get intimidated by the Derby Devonshire thing, nor did Derby Devonshire necessarily do it to rank him out. He may have. But the point I'm making is that by answering in his own accent, he was he, and the other guy was he. You know what I'm saying? He was he. So learn to be who you are. Don't try to change yourself. Believe me, I could speak corporatese as good as the next guy. I was a corporate consultant for many years. And I found out as time went on, I don't have to sound like I'm from the Midwest in order for people to understand me. They're listening to my ideas, and they will listen to the New York accent just as well. As a matter of fact, it's kind of engaging for many Americans because it is so unusual for them to hear an authentic New York accent in an age where everybody's been corporatized into some sanitized, homogenized, martinized American.
Savage.
We're trying to get down to a cultural phenomenon of I call them crack pants. And I, for the life of me, can't understand why anybody would want to deform their physique with such disgusting attire, to be frank with you. Now, I know this originated in the ghettos amongst drug dealers, as many fashions do. And then, of course, the drug addicts in the fashion business, who ape the degenerates on the streets, said, "Oh, how cool! Let's make those pants!" And then, of course, the white sheeple went along and they bought the pants, and the rest is history. So now you got the cultural phenomenon of skinny white kids with pants falling down under their ugly behinds all over America. I have men emailing me saying, "Mike, because of you, I'm going up to kids and saying, kid, your pants are falling down." And by the way, I have found something out. No one says it to them. They have no father. They have a liberal mother or a mother, to her credit, who works too hard to even notice. And the fathers aren't around because no father would let a son wear a pair of pants like that. And if someone says to me, "Kid, your pants are falling off," usually they're embarrassed. I guarantee you they'll wear normal pants the next day. You know, so I grew up, I remember when I was in junior high school, I wore pegged pants with, you know, saddle-stitched pegged pants. They cost a fortune. I was so, oh my God, it was like blackboard jungle, you know? I saved up for those pants. They were so cool. You know, they were on, whatever. They were beautiful, like Sal Mineo pants, okay? And I got into a schoolyard scuffle the first day I wore them because they were new, and a big kid pushed me down, and I remember ripping the pants in the knee. I was so heartbroken. I think for 10 years I never got over that. I went to a tailor, and he said, "I have to weave it." I didn't know what a weaving was, but I knew it was more costly than I could afford. So I do understand that boys will wear bizarre outfits during the teen years. However, it was generally sized. So if you had a 26 waist, you bought a pair of pants 26. You didn't buy a pair that was a 46 that fell down under your behind. Nobody would do that. So why would black people do that? They're fashion conscious. What is the meaning of this? I don't understand it. Maybe I don't understand black culture. Maybe you could explain it to me. So let's start in Phoenix, Arizona. Michael, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you. I would like to speak on this. I'm an expert on urban culture, and I understand if you want to procreate, the phenomenon of wearing your pants too big is essential. That's in the school system.
Let me see if I follow you. You're saying if you want to get a girl, you got to wear pants that fall down?
Well, if you don't assimilate, you will not procreate.
What do you mean by, no, explain to me what that means. What do you mean by assimilate into what?
If you don't assimilate to the popular culture, and please don't pigeonhole all of us together, but there are some school systems.
No, wait. But we're getting off the track. I am focused primarily on skinny white boys who are aping this style, which originated in the black ghetto. Am I correct about that or incorrect?
I think that you are incorrect about that. But it's more economics than anything else.
Oh, you mean if you pass it down from an idiotic brother who's a giant, then you can wear it? I mean, what do you mean more economic than anything else? You can't buy a pair that fits you? Or you get an oversized one and you can cut it up into two? I don't understand that.
A lot of African-Americans, a lot of economic striving individuals across this world cannot afford certain pants whatsoever, price ranges.
No, I understand, but wait a minute, but can't you buy them in the correct waist size? I'm still not following the oversized part of it.
If you want to procreate.
All right, you don't know the answer, fine, but you had fun, and it's nice to hear that you're listening anyway. I'm going to take a wild guess in the dark. If you make me guess, Michael Savage, why did that originate in the ghetto? And why do they wear oversized pants? It's to hide weapons and drugs from the police.
Savage.
I had a geometry teacher in high school. He had two fingers on his right hand. He was a tough guy. He was an Irishman and real tough, but a very good teacher, and the kind of teacher who made you come up to the blackboard and perform at the blackboard, and if you didn't, he ridiculed you. He didn't curse you out, but he called you a dummy, basically. He says, now, what's the matter with you today, Michael? Is your brain not functioning? That kind of thing. And believe me, you didn't want to wind up in front of that class not knowing your stuff because you didn't want to be humiliated in front of your peers called your classroom. Now, today, they take every moron off the street, every idiot, every dumb dyslexic, every idiot who has one eye going up, one eye going down. He can't talk, he can't see, he can't hear. And they tell you he's smarter than you are. And if you dare be smarter than him, you go to the back of the class. But in those days, it was very clear. If you were smart, you were smart. If you were stupid, you were dumb. And that was the end of it. And no one changed anything. So to make a long, he had a left hand with five fingers and a right hand with two fingers. And the two fingers were stubs. But he could still put chalk on a board. And when he said to you, the midterm exams are back, he would read out every name and every score publicly. Now, why do you think he did it? Because he understood that by doing well, you were proud of yourself and the kids looked up to you. And by doing poorly, you were ashamed of yourself, boys and girls, and you try to do better. But because the liberal perverts took over the schools, where they try to put perversion ahead of everything else, they have now taken dummies and try to make that better than the smarties. And consequently, the schools can't even teach Johnny how to add or read. And if Johnny's smart enough and he can't focus at all, they put him on Ritalin to dope him up and turn him into a sissy and a dumbbell who can't do anything except sit in a cubicle the rest of his life and possibly jump off a building when he's 25. Now, how Mr. W. lost his fingers is another interesting story. We all knew about it very fast. I forget his full name. It was Mr. W. And it was whispered in the halls of the high school that he lost his fingers, and I'm not glorifying it, planting a bomb for the IRA. Now, I don't know whether it was true, but it was certainly enough to make us understand not to mess around with this teacher. And we didn't. We respected him. Whether it was true or not is irrelevant. That's who we had for teachers in those days.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
When I was a kid, every summer, I loved the summer. What kid didn't? Because in those days, you didn't go to summer school. You didn't go to a camp to advance your mathematical knowledge, another to advance your sports knowledge, another to lose your tubby waist. You went and had fun for the whole summer. And we were kind of poor, so what we did was to get out of the hot inner city, the family rented a small cottage with all the other families from the neighborhood and relatives up in the cool mountains called the Catskill Mountains. And they were known as bungalow colonies because you got basically a one room, kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, bum. And your whole family was in there. But they were like, the whole thing was filled with your friends and their parents. So it became like a little village. Naturally, it was paradise because every other parent was your parent. And you reverted back to like another time in history. So it was wonderful. We'd play Indians out in the woods, and we'd carve trees and make canoes. God knows what we did. So in one of these places, there was a guy who was a caretaker who lived in an old abandoned barn with his wife, believe it or not. And he mowed the lawn. He had the hammer, fixed the hammer. His name was Woodchuck Bill. And us kids, it was like a Tom Sawyer thing. We loved Woodchuck Bill. Kids loved. Now, remember, he was not a bum. See, today they're bum. They're homeless. He was what was known as a hobo in those days. And there were people who were hobos. They were sort of respectable in their own way. That was his job category. He's like hobo. He would put it on the IRS. Like, what do you do? Job category, hobo. I don't know what he made, next to nothing. But he lived up in this, as I say, ramshackle barn-like structure with his. He had a wife, actually. And Woodchuck Bill would regale us kids with his stories. And he was a big guy with a big stomach on him. So the story begins with him saying, all right, kids, come over here. Today they probably arrest him for molestation, just for even telling us a story. Some freak would arrest him. He says, all right, I want all of you to punch me in the stomach. Now, right away, that's rape today. It's raping a child in some way. So we'd all go up with our skinny little arms. We were 9, 8, 7, and punch him in the stomach, and nothing would happen. So naturally, we thought he was Superman. He must have been pretty strong. I mean, if you think about it, because they're 8-year-old kids that can give you quite a belt even today. Anyway, so we all hit him, and we realized we were nothing compared to Woodchuck Bill. Then we'd sit at his feet, and he would tell us stories. He'd say, why, I swear, I can remember to this day, he would say, well, I've seen hurricanes, and I've seen tornadoes. Well, we sat spellbound, like really out of a book from the 19th century. So what I liked most about Woodchuck Bill was that he lived in this barn with almost nothing. He had his few pots and pans, him and his wife, and they hung from, like, hooks over the thing, and they actually cooked in there. But he said he used to eat woodchucks. We'd say, Bill, what do you eat? He said, we eat woodchucks. Who knows if he's telling the truth? I don't know if you can eat a woodchuck. And that's the Woodchuck Bill story. I mean, you wanted something more to it. There is nothing more. That's a jazz story. You got to understand jazz music to understand that story. It ends like boom, and the horn goes down. That's it. But unless you understand how jazz works, you're not going to be, like, satisfied, because you want a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then Bill raped us, and he was taken away by Child Protective Services, and we lived miserably ever after. No, it didn't happen that way. Today, they'd arrest him for just being Woodchuck Bill. They'd give him treatment. They put him on a pill, and he'd probably go berserk and kill people in the on the IRT, throw him on a third rail when the pill wore off. I feel the sap flowing in my veins. I feel springtime in my being. I saw my president speak. I felt proud of him. He stood the ground. He kept the course. He didn't get waylaid by the scum in the streets, the dirty bums. They don't have a job. They don't have a job. They got to block cars across America, those filthy SOBs. Then I watched the trucks, the taxis, the cars, the girls. Oh, the girls. Oh, the girls when springtime comes. I get younger and younger every year. See, I thought this disease would go away. But as I got older, I found out this disease gets worse. That's the disease of life.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
We're playing Italian music because I have a treat for you. I found the poem When Pasta Was Spaghetti in my archives. It was written, let's see, Michael Savage, August 1985, written in a lightning storm at 40,000 feet over Cheyenne, Wyoming, when I thought the plane was going to crash. I wrote When Pasta Was Spaghetti. So here it is, whether you like it or not, all right? So you liberals get ready to sneer, and you sane people get ready to enjoy it because it's a wonderful poem. So play the music again. Go ahead. They got the mood. We got the mood set up. It's called When Pasta Was Spaghetti, and try to imagine it, all right? The hairy forearms of New York serve you your coffee with a turning gesture, an offering that says drink, eat, enjoy. The wiry Italian in Vincent's clam bar, the one behind the greased over register, the young kid connected who receives his deference from the spaghetti cook older than his gangster father, the spaghetti cook who looks like an old-fashioned doctor from the Bronx with clipped mustache. He actually pulls some noodles out of the pot and eats them as they cook, looking to the grimy ceiling for his tender answer. Well, they used to call it spaghetti. Now it's pasta at $10 a plate. The smoky windows of Romeo's Spaghetti now offers radios and knickknacks. It was 50 cents a plate then, in neon letters that you couldn't miss, even through a fogged-over window on a cold winter's eve. There was life. Marinara sauce that smacked to the sea. noodles as long as your young arm, meatballs as fluffy as your dream of them, bread on the table you'd eat against your parents' admonitions that the meal was coming, the meal was coming, and men, some burly with black hairy forearms whose smiles scared you, and little skinny guys with the look of murder on their faces, and people who slurped their spaghetti straight to their mouths from the plate, one motion like Chinese shoveling rice at mouth with clicking sticks. That was gusto before it became a beer ad. That was taste before it became a synonym for fashion. That was spaghetti before it became pasta. Play the music, basta. Very good. I'll do that for private readings for $100,000 for my favorite charity, which is the Paul Revere Society. You want me at your party? You want me at your party? I'll come and read with pasta with spaghetti. What if I actually had a gangster call me up? Like, all right, Mike, we want you to come read that pasta with spaghetti. I'll give you 100 grand, nothing to us. I would do it. I would do it for 10 grand, let's say. I read that Chicken Behind gets $1 million per private performance. Could you believe this? The guy started as a street mime in San Francisco. $1 million, they say, gets for personal performance at someone's party. Unbelievable. I mean, there is a price at which you'll be a clown. That's all. That got me through my 18th year when I thought I was too good for anything. You ever go through that? That's how a lot of people wind up bums. They're too good to do anything, so they wind up doing nothing. They wind up living in their parents' house smoking dope. But they're waiting to, you know, be discovered. Everyone's got to sell out. You just got to, you know, just sell out for the highest price you can. That's the whole story.
Savage.
I wrote the best-selling book, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder, as you know, because it's 100% true. That's why it resonated with the American, the intelligent America. They understood immediately that the zeitgeist of the title said it all. It said it all, because the only explanation for liberalism is madness. In some cases, mild, in some cases, severe. How could they think these things unless they're crazy? Sometimes they're not totally crazy, just partly crazy, you know, a piece crazy. But they're crazy for the things that they do. But I once knew 20 years ago, I knew a medical doctor who was an early pioneer in acupuncture in America. He was in Sausalito on a houseboat. I forget his name. He was the nicest guy in the world. But he told me that according to acupuncture theory, and he was a good one. He had studied in China. He was first a legitimate, straightforward American medical doctor type of guy. And in the 70s, he went to China, and he came back, and he incorporated acupuncture, and it worked so well that he gave up regular medicine and was only an acupuncturist, blah, blah, blah. But he said, according to acupuncture theory, there's a thing called a sorter, S-O-R-T-E-R, that goes out in some people. And I said, what does that mean? It's the ability to sort out what is relatively important and what is relatively unimportant in a person's life. In other words, they distort. Their sorter is out. So, in other words, they would hit certain pressure points to make the sorter work again so that people could get things in order in their life. That's so typical of people who are extremist in their, unable to sort things out in their mind as to what's important, what's unimportant, whether it be in their own life or in the life of the society or their place in society, what's important. Their sorters are off. That's a form of illness. Whether you want to call it a mental illness is another story. But I will tell you that a lot of the statements that come out of the liberal orthodoxy is an example of this distortion. Maybe they need a good needle in the right place.
Savage.
Life has been good to me. I've had my share, as Bonnie the Undertaker said to me. At the end of his life, did I ever tell you about Bonnie the Undertaker? I hope his family's not listening. I told you about Charlie, didn't I? Charlie, the old man who was dying of cancer years later. And as he was dying in severe pain, and the girls went by in the market, he was moaning from cancer. But he still wore a neat little suit, tie, jacket, and his eyes through the slits because they were closed in pain. As the girls walked by, he'd say, oh, Mickey, he's in pain. I was a kid. But a pretty girl would walk by. He says, oh, Mickey, I got to put it in a family way. I got to change it a little bit because I grew up around men who were from, they spoke a little on the vulgar side. Even though I was a kid, they didn't check a dictionary. He said to me, I would like to make love to her once more as the woman went by. I said, you made love to her, the strange, beautiful woman? He says, no, Mickey. He says, once more, I'd like to make love to her. You know, he turned the words around. Now, this was a guy dying of cancer his entire life. Although he was poor, he considered himself a ladies' man. He wore cologne when no one wore a suit. But in the market next door, there was an undertaker guy. a dapper little fellow who chauffeured the undertakers around, the funeral cars around. So years later, when I was about 14, I asked him about women. And I said, do you monkey around or something like that? He says, no, Mickey. He says, I had my share. That was dignified. That a man would say, I had my share, was an amazing thing for me to hear. Because most guys pretend that they're in heat 24/7, you know, they're ready to rut like a rooster in a barnyard any second, and that every woman is fair game. You know, that's how guys put on the act. But in reality, most men really aren't like that. It's very unnatural to be in heat 24/7. But this guy was dignified. He said, no, Mickey, I had my share. That was the most dignified thing a man ever said to me.
Savage.
Here was the diet of the young savage. Now, mind you, it was meant because the parents came from a relatively, you know, impoverished background. I am very proud of that because they rose up. So what do poor people do when they get a little money? They feed themselves, and they feed themselves holiday foods three times a day. Everything that they would eat at a holiday when they were children, they gave their children for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So a typical breakfast would be ham and eggs, maybe four eggs, maybe a brick of ham. I'm not talking a slice. I'm talking Canadian bacon size, the size of your, at least your pinky. Ham and eggs, dripping the eggs, glass of milk. You had the 12 ounces of milk, and then a jelly donut to go to school with. Immediately, I had narcolepsy. And the minute I hit the classroom, zzz, Michael, what is 2 + 5? I had no idea. It was a drowsy. Thank God it snowed in my face. It woke me up just on the walk to school. But the minute I got there and took off the scarf, I got so drowsy from the heaters in the school, I went right to sleep. The next thing I knew, someone shook me, and it was lunchtime. Lunchtime, ring, ring, lunchtime, recess, meatloaf sandwich from the night before, some type of potato dish that was congealed in order for travel, for eating in haste. Some kind of type of congealed potato dish that was stuck together like with mortar, you know, beaten with a mortar and pestle with some kind of glue. It wasn't just a potato, you know, which is good for you. What the, glued potatoes. That was it. That was dinner, 5 o'clock, the early show. And there I was in front of the TV with a tray and steak, French fries, ice cream. And poor dad would come in the door around. I was still eating at 6 o'clock, mind you. He came home gray from the winter, from working, from worrying over his son who was going to become everything that he hated. And my mother's like slaving over catering. Seriously, I'm just telling you point blank what the upbringing. He comes in white from the day. And I see his eyes dart right over to the empty tray, steak, the leftover fries. I was like the young King Farouk in the making. I was on the ice cream point. Yeah, Ma, I'll have another one. Right, get me in the kitchen there. Go get me another one. Oh, we were terrible kids, so spoiled. Because they wanted some food like that. What are you waiting on? All right, you're coming to work with me on Saturday. No, I don't want to go down in that basement. Yeah, you're going to clean bronzes again. You and the Bowery bum, I pay 75 cents a week. You're going to go down there with the, and you'll clean those bronzes, and you'll know what it is to be a man. We're going to close you wear out here, you and your friends. What do you mean, Dad? We're just wearing clothing that is not black or gray. Never mind. Ah, come on, I go on and on. And it's absolutely true. And that's the way it was. Okay, but the point of the story is this went on for years and years and years. Now, if I were conducting human experiments and it was legal, I wouldn't do it to anybody. But if I wanted to conduct an experiment on what causes early death from coronary artery disease, that diet would be the model. That would be the epidemiologic model. You'd take somebody and put them in a prison, and you'd feed them the exact diet three times a day. For 5 years, you can induce a heart attack in a 7-year-old, I think, with that diet. So there must be a little bit more to it. You understand that there's got to be three parts to any disease pattern: diet or the environment, genes, and then there's another factor. There's whatever else you do, and a little luck thrown in the unknown. As I'm still ticking along here. Thank God I caught on to it young. Thank God I went to, you know, I left New York. I looked for the Fountain of Youth. I did the Ponce de Leon thing. And I investigated nutrition early on. First nutrition book I ever read was George Osawa's Zen Macrobiotics, the number 12 diet, brown rice. There's a diet that it will definitely give you longevity, but you don't want it. I mean, there's no reason to live. When you hit the number 12 diet, and they all got sick anyway. It was all a lie. All the guys who practiced those extreme diets, They all died of, like, liver cancer at 40. You ever noticed how many guys who were, oh, yeah, I'm a vegetarian years ago, a runner? They're all dead. The purists. I never touch animal products. I don't eat any fish, fowl, nothing from the sea. I do not touch dairy. I'm a lacto-ovo humanitarian, vegetarian, Unitarian. I absolutely don't touch it. You know, in a number 12, I live on a rice diet, rice-based, soy-based. And usually a liver cancer struck them or hepatitis somehow. I don't know if it was maybe kissing the girls with mustaches they got. I have no idea. Hanging around in dirty health food stores could do it to you, too. Just going in and breathing in the back from the old, you know, the moldy rice in the back that they try to sell.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
And on top of it all, a one-armed Frank level Hal. Did I ever tell you about one-armed Frank? You haven't heard the one-armed Frank story. Do I have a moment? My father, I told you, was an antique dealer. May he rest in peace. So we would come home from... Well, he had a guy who came in with one arm. I don't know how the guy became one arm, but he, you know, you didn't know a lot of people with one arms in those days. Even today, they have I guess you don't know one-armed people today, they have a fake arm. But he had the arm sewed up, you know, in a suit. So, all right, you accept him. His name, though, was One-Armed Frank. Because nobody hid reality in those days. Today, it's like, oh, yeah, he's normal. He's just like a... In those days, it was One-Armed Frank. Today, it's like, oh, he's better than normal, man. He's special. Like, if you have one arm, you're better than a guy with two arms today. You know what I mean? If you have no arms and no legs, you're Superman. In the politically correct world of today. But in those days, if you were missing an arm, that's what you would name, One-Armed Frank. Whatever your anomaly was, that was your name. It made it easier for the average person to remember everybody. So One-Armed Frank was a very sweet guy, but a breath on him. Now, I want to tell you, there are bad breaths, then there are very bad breaths, then there are medicinal problems. This had to be solved with a medicine that hasn't been invented yet. It was winter time, and once in a while, my old man would drive One-Armed Frank home, and I'd get stuck in the back, and One-Armed Frank would get shotgun. Now, I want to tell you something. It could be -4 degrees in New York. You had to ride with all the windows open. Did you ever have a person like this, Greg? I'm serious, where it's medicinally like a medical problem, where he says anything, and the car fills with a noxious fume. Where you don't know what to do. You know, are we going past the Trun's meat factory? No, we're not in Williamsburg. Did we run over a small furry creature that got caught in the muffler and shot up through the floorboard? Did I step on something on the way? No, it's Frank talking.
Savage.
Oh, God, look what I have to do for a living. I should have been a tailor. I could have sat in front of a treadle, not talked to anybody, just smoked Philip Morris and died at 47. Poor Grandpa. Didn't have a chance. Came over, brought the family over one by one from Europe. Ate his heart out in that tailor store on the Lower East Side. Made suits for guys, nice suits. Never got anywhere. Well, he owned his own store. He moved up. But he didn't have to talk to people like I do 3 hours a day, eating his heart out. I don't know. They all died so young. They had easier jobs than me. Why they dropped dead? I can't understand. It had to be the cigarettes. Don't say stress, because my stress level is 10 times worse than theirs. So don't give me that stress garbage. Mine is 100 times worse. I should have been dead at 11 with my personality and my consciousness. Stress is I studied this. The reason I went into nutrition and herbal medicine and looked for the searches all over the world and wrote all those books is because everyone died young in my family from heart attacks. And stress has almost nothing to do with coronary artery disease. Nothing. Zero. Don't believe a word of it. Life is stress by definition. Don't you understand that? And the more you struggle against stress, the more stressed out you are. Just accept that stress is life. And when you die, you have no stress. You know what I mean? Or if you move to Queens, one or the other. The point I'm making is stress has almost nothing to do with it. It's 90%. Okay, let me tell you what I've discovered and what the medical literature says. And please don't call me on this. We all know it anyway, but let me just say it again. It's about one-third, one-third, one-third for any disease. One-third genetics, one-third environment, and one-third unknown. There's an unknown factor in disease. Don't you understand that yet? I learned this in graduate school when I was going for my PhD. I'll never forget my professor. He was a medical doctor and a PhD, and he said to me, you know, he says, I've opened up people at autopsy who've died of heart attacks whose arteries are perfectly clean. Now, that's a mind blower. No occlusion. You know, Lipitor and garlic and vitamin, nothing. The arteries were clean like a baby, and they dropped dead of a heart attack anyway. So there's a mystery to disease. You understand that there's a mysterious element to disease, as there is to so much else in life. There's a mystery to love. There's a mystery to life. Not everything is so cut and dried. So that's why I say it's a third environment, which means smoking, exercise, nutrition, eating. A third genetics where you have nothing. You can't do anything about it. And then a third mystery. Now, since you can't affect your genetics, you can't affect your unknowns, you work on the others. That's all. You don't eat like a pig. That's all. You eat like a sane person who wants to live, and you take mega doses of vitamin E and vitamin C and all of the other B vitamins that you need to know, and you got to learn all of that stuff. And then you pray a lot. You pray to God every night that you don't drop dead and leave your children without a father at a very early age. That's everyone in their 30s, 18 times a day, they're touching their chest. Oh, yeah, that's it. They're driving in the car. How many guys listening to this show are laughing right now? They're driving. They're in their 30s. I imagine this because I know it. It was like the 30s are the worst age in life. In the 20s, you're still like, I'm not going to live forever. Nothing's going to affect me. You're in the post-teenage years. Nothing. Then in the 30s, you get the first gray hairs. You get a little flab on your stomach. And every day, if you're married and have children, I mean, if not, well, you can get away with another 10 years. Every day in your 30s, you're driving. Oh, what's that twinge? Oh, and you're sure you're going to go off on the side of the road upside down. You're going to be an embarrassment to your family, dying a horrendous death from the big one. So many guys in their 30s. But let me tell you something. It gets easier as you get older. Because once you realize you are going to die, it doesn't matter. You realize it. You know, don't freak out over it. 40s are easier. Then the 50s are even easier yet. What do I know? Depends upon if you're lucky or not. You don't get sick. My mentors are guys like 80 who aren't, those that have anything wrong with them. Still chasing women at 80. There are still men around like this. Astonishing.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I'm a little loopy today. I've been trying not to tell you the story, but, you know, since radio to me is a bit of a confessional and I swore to Mrs. Savage I wouldn't tell the story, I can't tell you why I'm a little loopy today. If she would call and say you can, I will do it. Well, wait a minute. Is there a way around this? I'll have to think about it. Oh, big deal. It's not that big a story. So I went aground in the mud yesterday. I had to wait for the high tide for 6 hours. And the dogs got scared as night descended upon the bay and we were stranded. Ah, what the heck? What the heck if the Coast Guard came and couldn't do anything for us because the mud was so deep and we were so far in it? I was not piloting. Incidentally, you want to see how many metaphors I can tell you about going aground? And I mean hard aground. Hello, this is Michael Savage. I'm hard aground somewhere in the vicinity of the Richmond Yacht Harbor. You know what had happened just before that? And there's so many metaphors to this story. Well, first of all, there's good and bad in everything. I don't know if you know what going hard aground means. If you hit a reef, you usually go down because the reef cuts the bottom of your boat open and you sink. if you're not watching what you're doing, or you're not reading your charts right, or your depth chart, depth finder is off, you might go up on mud. And if you do and you go in at a low tide, you're going to wait 6 hours for a high tide to float you off that mud, which I had to do. It could have been much worse. I could have gone hard aground at high tide, which means I would still be there because there's no way off at high tide. But you know something? I'm an impatient guy. And I've heard the phrase, God, it was as boring as watching paint dry. No, sir. I've got something better for you for a new metaphor, but it's not so generally known that people would get it. It's as boring as waiting for the tide to come in, because that's what we had to do. Went aground at 3 o'clock, called the Coast Guard. They came out. They couldn't get within 100 yards of us. All I said was drop your anchor, put on your life jackets, and have a nice day. He said to me, the next high tide is at midnight. You should be able to float off at 10 o'clock tonight. I said, yeah. So from 3 o'clock to 10, the dogs couldn't make. And that's the part that bothered me the worst. I mean, we had food and water. It wasn't life-threatening. But the fact is that the poor doggies got to me. Teddy was worried because he was up on the bow of the boat and looking, and he could smell the land. He could almost hear people. It wasn't that far away. And the poor boy, after 4 or 5 hours, he had to go. And I got to the point where my little finicky, everything has to be perfect boat, I said, Teddy, crap on the deck. Please. Dump on the upholstery. Teddy, pee on the steering wheel. Whatever you got to do, I don't care, man. This is an emergency. Okay, let go of the anal retentive stuff, man. Do it. Dump on the sofa. He didn't do it, but the little one did. She listened. She overheard, and the teacup peed on the sofa, which I really don't care. But I got to tell you something. Any couple can go aground. It depends upon what the couple is made of as to whether how they get off that sandbar. And a lot happens in a few hours. And this is no heroic thing. I'm not putting the context of being adrift for 29 days in a lifeboat and killing a sea turtle and drinking each other's urine. You know, I'm not talking about that. In my little hothouse rose life, the life that I lead, the little constrained life that I lead, it was somewhat of a big deal to go aground because I'm a careful guy. I never make mistakes like this. My boat is my treasured possession. I'm also a very careful boater. But there's a little story coming. For about 1, 2, 5 minutes, I relaxed. I went below. I put on a pair of shorts. I don't wear shorts. I don't like shorts. I hadn't worn shorts since 1970, but it was a balmy day. I said, oh, look at this, Bermuda shorts. And I sat backwards up on the flybridge, and I lifted my legs up, and I wasn't even drinking. The next thing I know, nothing's happening. All right, these things happen. It was my mistake for not paying attention. Da, 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 da. I'm not blaming anybody because ultimately it's my boat and I'm the captain. So therefore, it's my responsibility. But the fact of the matter is we had to sit for 6 hours. And, you know, we didn't even go aground at low tide. We went aground an hour before low tide, which means that we had to wait an hour and watch the mud come up even higher. And then I went down in the dinghy and went around the boat, and this thing looked like it was in dry dock, sitting in the mud. I got to tell you, as a guy who's finicky about the maintenance of his craft, it didn't feel very good. And that's what it was. So it got dark, and there was nothing to do. And I couldn't run the a generator because there was no water to cool it. So we had to sit in the dark and talk to the dogs. I couldn't sleep. I was agitated. And all I was doing was waiting for the water to come up. It's a very slow process. You can't rush God. God has his own little time frame. And as I've said to you many times, God sees the truth but waits. This had nothing to do with God. Or did it? Well, I think it did. It actually did. Because over the last few days, I turned my back on God over the last week. I had gotten cynical about God. I did. Now, normally I'm a God-fearing man. God is with me every second of the day, 24 hours a day. Doesn't mean I'm a haloed guy, not by any means. But I, you know when I'm doing the right thing and the wrong thing. And for the last week, I started to get cynical about religion and God and who needs it and who are they, and I can't stand them all. And you know what? The heck with it. I think I'll become a Hindu, and I think I'll get statues with arms on it just to shock the neighbors. I was reaching that point. Well, how do I know that God didn't speak to me in a quiet way and give me just a light slap on the wrist saying, go ahead, keep it up. Go ahead. We'll just put you aground in a little mud and let you float off in 6 hours. And then you'll have to go home in the dark without. Oh, by the way, your emergency radio will quit too, which it did. Can you believe this? This thousands of dollars radio that I'd like to strangle the guy who made me, sold it to me, because I wanted the cheap one. He sold me this piece of crap. I hated it from the day I got it. It died on me just when I needed it. So now I have to go home in the dark on the bay by line of sight, no radar, no chart plotter. And you know what? I did fine because I have very good night vision. But finding your harbor at night without radar, without any guidance is very interesting. It brings you back to a different part of yourself and actually opens you up to, just different feelings. And then when I got the boat in, I will tell you I had not two, but three vodkas straight in a row. And it didn't feel bad. As a matter of fact, it felt quite good. That third vodka, by the time the third vodka hit the brain center, which I aimed for, God, if only there was a little spot in your head you could open. See, if I were to talk to God when I get there and say, look, why don't you redesign us? Here's what I'd suggest. Put a little spout on the top of the head that you could put something in and you could just pour it right in on the brain. Why kill the other cells? You know what I mean? Anyway, by the time I hit the third vodka and I was sitting on the deck looking at the boat, and she was so beautiful. I mean, I don't blame the boat. I blame me, okay? She was so good. This boat is so great. Right after the show, I got to run to the boat, and I got to open up the sea strainers, which is quite a job for me. And I got to take out she ran fine, cool. I purged the mud because I ran it slowly. I don't know what's in there. I just want to clean them up. This is a good boat. She was good to me. And I don't know what I'm just telling you this story. So I'm a little loopy. Yeah, that's the reason I'm miscuing, and some of my words are getting slightly a slur because it was a disturbing experience. And the dogs are a little today, you know. Teddy looks hurt. As a matter of fact, when I sat on the deck with the third drink, he gave me his hind. I mean, I don't mean he gave it to me to take. He put his behind towards me. He wasn't like, oh, happy, Dad, I'm happy. We're all No. It wasn't like a cartoon. It wasn't the Donald Duck and Walt Disney, the ending of the cartoon. Teddy turned his behind towards me as if to say, look what's under my tail. That's what you are, okay? I don't steer boats, right? I'm just a dog. I'm a couple of pounds. I trusted you, okay? And you went aground, okay? Look under my tail. That's who you are. You got it? And don't even talk to me, all right? Have a nice night. All I can think about in those, you know, to me it was a big deal because I'm impatient. 6 hours sitting on a mud bank waiting for the tide to come up is a very long time. I couldn't run a generator. I had no inverter, so I had no electricity. So there were no lights in the boat, and you had to just watch the light fall and it get dark. I'm not saying we were starving or in danger, but with the two little dogs on the boat, it became more real for me. I mean, I could wait it out, you know, and I had a head to use. They didn't. I tried everything. I said, Teddy, here's the sink. I put him in the sink. I said, pee. No. Here's the toilet. Watch, Daddy. Look how I do it. Stand up. No, he wouldn't do that. And I felt bad for the guy. I mean, you know, you start feeling bad for the dog. They're so housebroken, at least he is, that he wouldn't break rank with his own training and do anything. And you know, I didn't want – I don't know what it is. I like, that bothered me more than anything other than the embarrassment. Sal, KNEW, San Francisco. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm an ex-commercial fisherman, and once we're stuck for about 20 hours high and dry in a 32-foot commercial gill netter up in Alaska.
Well, I feel better that you as a professional can go aground. I was told by a man rode by late at night, and he didn't know if the boat was abandoned, and I talked to him on the rail, and he said, I figured you were stuck on the mud. He said, look, someone once said if you're easily embarrassed, you know, don't go into boating. Because apparently this happens to a lot of people, Sal. How did it happen to you, though, as a professional with all that equipment?
Well, we're fishing the side of a river. It's called the Egigic River in Bristol Bay. And basically there's a lot of sandbars. You know, you're using your there's not a lot of equipment because the river's running so fast. You got to remember, low tide there may be minus 4 or 5 feet. High tide may be 22 feet.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. What a differential. So in other words, there are a lot of pockets at low tide of sandbars.
Right. So what happened was at that time, the high tide was like 19 and a half feet or something. And about a half hour after the tide turned, we got stuck. We got stuck on a sandbar. So
you got stuck at high tide?
We got stuck an hour after less than an hour after the tide turned. The problem was the next high tide was only a 14-footer.
Oh, my God. So what did you do for those 20 hours?
Well, we sat there, we ate, we drank around for a while, because, you know, like...
Well, I mean, you were able to get out of off the boat?
Yeah.
Oh, because you're on a river.
Yeah, we're in the river, so it was, like I said, it wasn't real soft mud.
Yeah, I wouldn't have mind walking to a 7-Eleven. Unfortunately, we were sort of in a bay, and I couldn't go on land. I would love to have just abandoned the boat, but I didn't want to abandon it. So anyway, apparently this is quite a common experience, Sal, so that's why I'm not ashamed to talk about it. And I learned a lot. Thanks for the call. I learned by trial by fire. Spokane, Washington. Tom, you're up on the Savage Nation.
Hello, Mr. Savage. Pleasure to talk to you because you're so intelligent. I'm not even close. But anyway, I worked on the water for 22 years and heavy marine construction. Worked in the Bay Area for 9.5 years and have been aground myself. But the next time that you realize that you go aground, immediately, you have twin screws, right?
Okay. Yep. Hold on. We'll come back to this because I tried everything I would do with a car stuck on ice, and all it did was dig it in deeper like a plane crashing in the sand. I'll be back.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
We can talk about going aground and the metaphors of going aground. And believe me, there are numerous metaphors for going aground. Whether you're a boater or not, everyone in this audience today, everyone sitting here listening to this show or driving in a car or sitting in a prison cell or working in a machine shop or listening to the show in some other way, has gone aground in their life. Everyone listening to this show should understand that going aground in their life is part of living. No one listening to the show will ever have smooth sailing from birth to from cradle to grave. That's not the way life is. Life is not only going aground, life is also having the hull cut out from under you, etc., and so on. The point I'm making is it's not that we're all going to go aground or have gone aground in our lives, whether through the metaphor or through the realities of going aground. It's how you handle it. Do you freak out? Do you blame somebody else? Do you say the white man made me go aground? Do you say the black man made me go aground? Or do you say, well, I'm aground, and how do I get off this mud? You know, and that's the whole issue here. Is that you can blame anyone you want. No one can stop you. It's a free country. You can scream about J. Edgar Hoover. You can scream about George Bush. You can scream about Dick Cheney. You can scream about Tom DeLay. You can say anything you want, but it's not going to get you out of that mud. The only thing that's going to get you out of the mud is realize what you got to do. And that's life itself. There's a metaphor in that regard as well. So, I mean, there's a whole, you know, without getting too sentimental about it, it's an interesting story, I thought, and worthy of discussion. 1-800-449-8255. Tom, we're going back to you in Spokane, boating country. Go ahead, please. In a nutshell, what should be done, in your opinion, when you go aground?
Okay, well, I know the bay mud real well. And like I said, I have been aground. What you need to do, it depends on, you know, which way your bow is facing, the stern, of course, you know, but you want your stern heading towards, you know, the deeper water. You got to put it in reverse. It will suck the water under your boat. It will blow the mud out and raise your boat up at the same time. And I'll tell you, I've made it out.
Tom, what weight boat do you have?
Well, no, this was at work. It was like tugboats, you know.
Oh, big boats, okay. Yeah, well, look, I take it from an expert. I tried that. It didn't work. In fact, the silhouette of the boat was she dug herself right into the mud. We had to wait for the tide. And, you know, the Coast Guard said we have a computer model. It's going to come up. You're going to have 6 feet of water, and you can get out at midnight. I took off at 9:45 when I had about, 4.5 feet under the boat. Here's the beautiful part of the story. When you're stuck there and the boat's not moving and you're in a bay, it's a terrible feeling. And as the water starts to come up hours later and you start to feel that slight rocking and you know that you're floating again, You know what I'm saying? It's an amazing feeling to feel yourself floating again. Again, there's a metaphor there. It's a beautiful story in its own way, but you have to be a boater or, I don't know, maybe an athlete. I don't know what you have to be. Maybe you just have to listen to know. Let's say when you're in a boat and you're used to floating. What are you going on a boat for but to feel a sensation of floating, right? So now when you're not floating and you're stuck, you're landlocked again. Now when you feel the water coming back underneath you and you're slightly floating, slightly, you're thrilled. You lift your hook and you're out of there. Just go slowly, run it for 3-4 minutes to drive the mud out of the damn thing, and that's the end of the story.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
This is an anti-Viagra song called Come Softly to Me, My Darling.
Come softly, darling. Come
in fact, this could be the theme song of the National Organization for Women. We didn't know it. Had no idea it was propaganda. Come softly to me. It was a brainwash. I didn't know. All right. Thank you very much. Give him a few whatever. And I'll be right. Now, where am I? I got some callers to take, too. Wow, the show's flying. It's amazing what a Friday can do to you. Oh, I said caponize. The caponize the whole generation. I looked up the word capon. For those of you who don't know what a capon is. A castrated male chicken. And that comes from the English for a castrated male chicken. That is right above Kappa Regime in the dictionary, which is a lieutenant in a criminal mob. I swear to God. Capon is right above Kappa Regime, Kappa Regime. And above Cap Pistol. But it's also near capitalism, actually, if you want to get into it. I don't know. There's a relationship. Of course, today, a castrated male chicken would more readily reference Hollywood than anything else.
Savage.
Did I tell you about the chestnut man? I didn't tell you about the chestnut. Oh, there were a lot of crazy people in those days that were on the streets. Well, today they are too, but they're holding microphones and they're working for CBS. So one of our subway rides, cold, nasty, miserable, snowy winter day slush, 11 years old, dressed up, like smoke coming out of your mouth that was so cold. Your face was red. Your hands could freeze if you took a glove off. I love that weather. So there was like a bimmy who sold chestnuts outside the I used to love the Museum of Natural History. I loved the Mastodon. I liked the gem collection. I didn't know it in those days. It shaped a lot of my future to show you the greatness of our culture. When I'd go to the Museum of Natural History as a kid and I saw exhibits of a natural scene from the Fiji Islands with birds, little did I know that years later I would actually seek out that kind of thing in my life professionally, shaped no doubt in part by the great cultural institution of the Museum of Natural History. Of course, this is all lost today on the Islamo-fascists and the TV generation and the internet and iPod. I don't know what these children are going to become. What is their dream? What kind of dreams do these idiots have? I haven't any idea. It's very sad that children have no dreams, no nothing. I think everything's in, you know, like, oh, I'll give you another example. Oh, so the chestnut man, then I have another story from last night. I'm going to tell you the last night's story before the chestnut story. After work, I went on one of my one-hour walks around downtown San Francisco. I need to burn off energy. Hat tilted low, collar up, anonymous. No one knows me. Till I open my mouth, then heads turn. So I don't say anything. So I like to go and look into restaurants and bars, and I like seeing people going home and the hustle and bustle. It's kind of a fun thing at the conclusion of the day for me to see that in this gorgeous, beautiful city of San Francisco. So one of the places I stop in is like this Shishi Hotel. It's got a bar scene. I like to see the hubbub and the scene. I never liked the bar scene when I was young, and I'm not in the bar scene, but I like to watch it sitting in a lobby. So I'm sitting in a lobby on a chair, and the bar thing is over there. Hundreds of people, yeah. I mean, the kids in their 30s all looking. Everyone's a 7 in there. Which is actually why it's more fun. They probably go home with each other. 7s go home with each other. The 9s and 10s go home, you know, to psychopathic behavior. The sevens at least go home with each other because they don't think they're God. So it's a place packed with sevens, and I'm sitting in a chair outside in the lobby, and I'm watching the comings and goings. Every girl that comes through the lobby pulls out a cell phone, and even though they're alone, they're all looking in the cell phone, talking. They're making believe that they have somebody they're waiting for. That's the latest gimmick, and they think someone's buying into it, that if you pull out a cell phone, it means you missed the date's late, and you're there, and you're busy, and you're popular. And they're all staring in it like a text message. They're looking like inside a fortune teller's crystal to see if they can find a visage of the truth inside this little instrument in their hand, is how it struck me. If I were like from another planet looking in, I said, what kind of madness is this? What kind of species is this that young females who are searching for husbands to settle down and have children are walking around with a device in their hand, and instead of talking to a man, they're talking to this device in their hand and looking at it and staring in it as though it's the Holy Grail itself. Now, to go back to the chestnuts in the open fire. We're outside the museum, freezing slush cold, and one of these bimmies is selling chestnuts on the, you know, and they're delicious. Man, they roast them out there. Do they still do that? I don't even know if they allow them anymore. And a guy, I'm with my friend, we're 11, and he turns out, he says to us, hey, you guy, I talked a weird voice. He was a big guy. He looked like the guy that George Michaels was allegedly cavorting with in a park there in London, got hushed up, like on the, you know, the rough trade type. But a little like lower class than that, even a little more nutty. And he says, hey, you kids want to see pictures of girls? So right away, I knew he was a dangerous guy. So we play him along. Yeah. Where do you got those pictures? You kids come with me. Come with me. It's only a subway ride. I'll show you those pictures. We didn't go with him, but we knew that he was a pervert. How did we know? Because we're allowed to ride the subway at 11 instead of being locked up behind a web page.
Savage.
I had a nutty friend, a real SOB, a piece of garbage. He was a miserable rat, even as a kid, a miserable rat, because he had a crazy mother who was on Benzedrine to lose weight. She went to some crazy doctor in Jersey who put her on speed. She'd come back nuts. I mean, crazy. And she'd drive the pink Cadillac. They had a little more money than everyone else. The father was hardworking. She was a nothing. Always on Benzedrine and a wacko. She was so crazy that she would take a dog chain. She once did this and beat herself across the wrists, and they were bleeding. So when the husband came home at night, like from working all day from some delivery route that he owned, he had a franchise, whatever, she came screaming. She said, Joe, look what your son did to me. Look what he did to me. And the father would go upstairs, and he had a fist fight with the son because the crazy mother said that the son did this to her wrist when she did it herself. Can you believe this kind of situation? So I have no compassion for him. He was a rat before that, and he's still a rat. He's still a no-good-nick. But he was a good friend of mine when I was in the fifth grade, because who knows? You don't know people. And since I was sort of a mischievous child, naturally I sought out the more mischievous of the students, those who fidgeted the most, had the brightest eyes, and never listened to the teacher. They were my kind of people. Today already they put us into Ritalin therapy and turn us into robots. I wouldn't be on the radio today. I'd be like an accountant somewhere in a prison. I'd be counting underwear for a prison somewhere to make sure that the underwear didn't get stolen. But the long and short was, yeah, he had a crazy mother. That doesn't excuse him for being nuts. As years went on, one of the kids in the neighborhood became a very famous, two of them became famous rock and roll singers, two, out of Queens. I won't mention their names. One had a big hit at 11 or 13 years old. He was always more mature than us. He had, like, women. You know, like guys at 13, like the guys with a pompadour, and he had, like, a girlfriend 19. I never understood that. We were still, like, dreaming. This guy had, like, a woman. You know, she was 20. I don't know how they got that. Like, through the music business, they probably gave him a... So he went and did a tour, this musician, in Japan at 14. Dropped out of high school. He had one song. It was a huge hit, like 145. I don't remember. It wasn't Runaround Sue, but it was in that genre. So he goes to Japan, a big tour. The Japanese always liked American rock and rollers. Now he comes back. Now it's years later. Now he's on his behind. And he's got nothing. So he becomes a U.S. postman. I swear to God, years later, the same rock and roller who had the Jaguar before anyone could even drive, the blue Jaguar, the cuff that stood out of the jacket, the pompadour, became a postman. There's nothing wrong with being a postman, but you know, you start out as a rock and roller and you end up as a postman. That's a pretty hard row, you know what I'm saying? It's better to start out as a postman and end up as a rock and roll star. Let me tell you. What'd you say I was going to talk about before I told that story? He had a blue Jaguar, an XK140 MC drophead coupe. To this day, I want that car. have a Ferrari. I still want that 56 XK140 drop head coupe. So that bad kid, going back now to the bad kid whose mother beat herself on the arm. So we like to go around all over New York by subway, and we were like 12, 13. We went everywhere. 12, 13, 14, Manhattan, Hubert's Flea Circus, down in the bowels of the basement of the subways, there were guys selling, like, they weren't porno magazines. They were soft core. And the old, you see the old geezers there lining up looking at the magazines. We try to, like, you look at them, hey, kid, get out of here. Get out of here, kid. Get out of here. You know, that kind of thing. So we used to like to go to Coney Island, and they had exhibits. I don't know how to describe it. They were like mannequins of wax figures. And there were some of them were scary as heck. Well, one of them was of George Metetsky, the mad bomber of the subway. And it was so lifelike. Like, if you were a kid 12 and you had just been on a New York subway car in the heat for an hour and you went out to Coney Island, you stood outside one of those exhibits and you looked in, they showed him like in a jail cell. The guy looked like he was going to come out of the cell and strangle you. Well, adjacent to that mad bomber display, there was another guy. This scared me to this day. I have nightmares about him. It showed a guy, I don't know what he did, dismembered girls or women. I don't remember what he did. He was really bad, this one. And he looked like Ordinary Joe, white guy, ordinary guy. And they found him. I remember it was like a mad thing in New York. They didn't know what to do. Girls were being found dismembered. Finally, they tracked this nut down to a chicken farm in New Jersey. I don't remember his name. And he's got like a corpse in a trunk under the bed. I mean, the whole thing, man. So this exhibit in Coney Island of the wax figure shows this guy reconstructed in wax in a little room in the back of a chicken farm with a dismembered girl's body in a trunk, and he's got like blood on his feet with like a blank stare at you, and they show you like the feet and the hands and the blood. It was stuff that today they could never ever show you, but life was richer as a result. For example, they had freak shows in those days. A genuine freak show is not so bad. The freak had a job.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
My dream of a lodge. My dream of a lodge, because it's summer, you know, everyone I know is going somewhere. They're like children. They have a vacation, and I don't. Boo-hoo. I mean, I could have a vacation if I wanted. I could just take time off, but I have nowhere I really like to go. Say, well, why don't you like to go? A, I don't like crowds. B, I don't like the places I go to. I can't sleep, blah, blah, blah. So then I'm thinking, what would I really, really like? And I'm thinking what I'd like is a lodge that I own, mind you. Let's say 4,000 or 5,000 feet, alpine flora. It doesn't have to be 5,000 feet. It could be 6,000 feet. I would like it in the state of Washington. I'm fantasizing now. Somewhere on Mount Rainier, I would assume. I don't know if there's any such private lodge available, whether it's not all state-owned or federal. And I'd like to have it with an owner's room or dwelling on it as well. And I would have a retreat for myself that I'd go to. I'd broadcast from up there with a special broadcast studio, and the guests could watch me broadcast through, a partition, and they would enjoy the normal facilities of a lodge. The food would be great. The drinks, the bar would be great, and it would be conservatives only. I mean, I would make sure liberals couldn't get in there. I would exclude them. I wouldn't let them in, and anyone who behaves too liberally, we throw them out. That's all. Throw them out of the bar. I know a guy who owns a restaurant out in Inverness, California. I love this guy. He really knows what communism brings. He skied out of Czechoslovakia when the Soviets took it over in 57. He was a world-class skier. So he went up over one of the mountains and skied into Austria and escaped. Well, he owns a lodge out there. I haven't seen him in years. A great man, wonderful man. I'll never forget. I went into his place, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I don't know when. Time moves on so quickly. And I had my dog. He has a wonderful little old lodge, and he cooks the food himself. And so I had my dog. I said, well, I guess I can't bring it in. He says, hey, you can bring it in. He says, he's better than most of the customers out here. Bring him in. So I said, well, I'll keep him. He says, no, put him up on a stool. He said, here, give him a bowl of water on the bar. He didn't care about an inspector. So I started to like this guy, and I went back there once on a crowded Sunday in the winter, and he had a roaring fire, like a European inn. The food was, you know, bountiful and heavy, you know, high cholesterol, but delicious once in a while, the heavy, wonderful meats and this and that. So he used to walk around and talk to the customers and engage them in a bellowing voice. And he said to one of the guys who was there, he didn't like, he said, "Well, what do you do for a living? You work for the Bank of America," he said. He said, "Get out of my restaurant. I don't want a usurer in here." He threw him out of the restaurant with his party of four people. He didn't care what the bill was. They had wine and dinners. He didn't want the payment. He said, "Well, let me pay. I don't want you to pay. I don't want your dirty money." He was that kind of guy. I loved him. I hope he's still living. I haven't been out in there in a while. Saddle, Washington. Jason, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mike, when you're looking for that lodge in around Mount Rainier, make sure you stay away from Enumclaw, right?
That's the animal sex area, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, let me ask you, you're from Seattle. Are there lodges like this on Mount Rainier that are not government-owned or state-owned?
The only lodges I know about, Mike, are the pink ones. I don't know any of the ones probably you're looking for.
Oh, it's full of pinkos up there?
Oh, yeah, it's pinko country.
Oh, how that's disgusting. Trump. They took over everything. It's like a gigantic nudist camp to them. The whole country is a place to just debase themselves in. Thank you for the call. 1-800-449-8255. 1-800-449-8255. I know that number in the middle of the night. And the website's michaelsavage.com. I'm going to go slow today. I'm going to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. Thank you very much, Muhammad Ali. That's how I feel. It's summertime. The pace changes. It always does. If you know my show, in the summer I slow down a little. I have a different pace of a show because, A, a lot of the people are on vacation, number one, they're not listening. And number two, if you're listening to me and you're already on vacation and your tempo is slowed down, I slow down slightly. And it's a little, in certain ways, more enjoyable. So I don't burn at my normal frenetic pace. But for me, that's 190% of the average talk show host anyway. WOR, New York, Matt, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I agree with you about that lodge up there in like Seattle or something like that, but I'll tell you where you really want to look maybe is like around to the west of Kelso on the Lewis and Clark Trail. If you go west towards Astoria, the mountain views are just stunning. They're beautiful. And
no, but Matt, here's the thing. I'm not looking for mountain views. Why do you think I picked an alpine area? Because I'm a highly allergic individual. In an alpine environment, there's much less pollen. And the chances of me having a pollen-free spring would be great at an alpine level because it's usually sort of in a snowpack until July. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you what, Mike. If you ever open one up, you let me know. I'll be your first customer.
I know. No. I got a lot of hundreds of thousands of people would want to be there. And I know exactly what it would look like. I can sense the menu. I know exactly what it'd be like. I get chefs who would want to work at this place just to be around the customers. It'd be a great place to have, but, you know, I don't know if anything like this exists. The reason I don't want it in upstate New York is because I want an alpine altitude. I want the alpine flora. I keep repeating that over and over again. A real alpine flora. Remember, I'm a trained botanist, so I know what I'm saying. When I say alpine flora, I know what I'm speaking about. I'd like to move into the semi-ice age, you know, come the spring and summer. Maybe Idaho. I don't know if there's alpine lodges. Again, I'm going to get a lot of people offering me places for sale, like in Monticello, New York, owned by a Hasidim. I don't want that. I don't want a bungalow colony with an old casino. Mike, I got a place for you for sale in Hurleyville. You can't believe it. It's beautiful. It's run down a little. Alpine schmalpine. We'll paint pictures on the wall for your little snow. You'll think you're in alpine New York. No, I say alpine, real alpine, genuine alpine, not the Red Apple Rest, not the Jewish Catskills. I want alpine. Then I'll bring a polka band up there. I'm having a whole fantasy. They'd come up in the outfits. It would be what fun we would have. Finally, at this point in my life, is to bring them up there and have it all run the way I want it run properly. Just the great place. You know, it's a dream. I mean, it's very hard to pull this off. Very hard to get what you really want in life. You have to learn is to take what you can get, not what you want. And then you realize what you really want and what you can get are two different things. And what you want and what you need are three different things. That's the most important rule an adult can learn, is the differential between what you want and what you need. What a big thing that is. And do you really need what you have? No. But we all have more than we need. That's why some of the problems are occurring. We all know that. It's not that we're greedy. It's human nature, I suppose, to want three cars or four when you really only need, let's say, one or two. Everyone has a little collectible. I do have the old caddy. I don't need it. It's a pain in the neck. It stinks. No matter what I do, it stinks and rots in the garage. I don't know what to do with it. I had it in last 2 weeks ago, again, dripping and leaking after the seal. The guy spent 3 weeks ago, Dave, and then he finally found that the main seal was dripping, a little 25-cent. So I said, oh, great, it won't stink in the garage anymore. So I buy a new pan, put it in the garage, a reek in there, it smells like a funeral parlor.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Play Honey Love. I'm going to do this. We're going to do the select. The guys picked rock and roll for Friday for me. I'm sure I won't like any of them. Let's listen to Honey Love by the Drifters. We'll go down the list. Kill It. I hate it. Next. I Want to Be the Leader by the Marcells.
I want to be the leader, leader of the group.
I'm off the show. I voiced like that, no leader. Lily Maybell by the Valentines. All right, give the kids a contract. Give them a contract. Give them $50 a piece. This is good. It'll be a hit. Starting to sound like Howie Rosenberg in the record industry in 1950 in New Jersey. You can tell this would have been a hit. All right, that's good. Now let's hear Zoom by the Cadillacs. Make believe I'm a record producer. All right, it's a follow-up tune. It'll sell half of their first song, but... All right. I don't want to see him in here again. This is the last song they'll ever do. After this is the Vegas and Reno shunt. Let me hear the Surfing Bird by the Trashmen.
Well, everybody's heard about the bird.
Yeah, this will work with geeks down in Alabama. That'll be good. See, I would use this for a sound effect with a helicopter gunship over Ramadi. Play it loud. Imagine this now. A loaded gunship, incendiary devices, and George Bush is taking a one-year vacation as commander-in-chief. He's riding his mountain bike somewhere. And they put a general in charge of the soldiers instead of a politician. No. Yeah, well, you could use it. No, this is not it. Turn that off.
Savage.
The deep right field. That ball is going. It is gone.
And there is the nostalgia setup, the Mel Allen voice, one of the greatest voices radio has ever heard, and one of the earliest radio voices that I came to love. And here I am sitting in front of a microphone with a radio voice that millions love, with another story that will be in my autobiography. And it's called My First Embalming, since we talked about The Undertaker, and here it is. I was now a late teenager, and I had gone to Europe, big trip to Europe. You know, hippie, beatnik trip to Europe, see the museums, blah, 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 came back on a ship. I come back from Europe, and I thought I had become a little off base. It was a little kind of teenage angst, little nuts. So I took a job in a mortuary at Queens General Hospital. I remember it to this day, red brick, big smokestack, looked like a crematorium. And I go in there as an assistant to just basically mop up and sweep up in a mortuary. And I had never seen an embalming. I don't know why I took that job of all jobs. It was like a bizarre choice to begin with. I guess it proves I was a little off-base after going to Europe. But then again, I wouldn't be the first nor the last person to come back from Europe and think they were a little crazy. Just take a look at Europe. So I go down into the thing, and the guy gives me an apron and a mop. And he says, they're just basically your job is to mop up the floor. But meanwhile, I'm watching the autopsies. This was not now this is really my first autopsy, not my first embalming. It's my first autopsy. So I watched a doctor. Now, here's a doctor with a medical degree. He was a medical examiner performing an autopsy. He has a cigar in his mouth, which I thought was weird and kind of disrespectful to the dead. The guy is chomping on a cigar. He cuts open a dead woman's head, like the top of her head, to pull back the skull cap and to remove the brains for, you know, that's what an autopsy is you examine the organs. And I'll never forget it as long as I lived. She happened to have been an African-American lady and a large woman, and he was pulling and pulling and pulling, and the skull wouldn't pull off. And he puts his foot up against the gurney that she's on, or the stainless steel thing, and pulling and cursing and the cigar, and I'm mopping the kid in the room there. I couldn't believe what I'm watching. And finally, he curses, and there it comes out, and that's it. So now then I see another man. A man must have been 50, 55, white man in good shape, just slim, gray-haired, but not old-looking, dead. And he was completely naked, as you would expect, on a slab. And the kid's mopping, and I look very carefully at the corpse. And I noticed some semen on his thigh, which, again, was novel and unique, because I didn't understand much about death at that time, as much as I since learned. And then there was a young child, 2 or 3 years old, as beautiful as a doll. Blonde hair, blue eyes, like a doll. Still and dead. For no reason. Still and dead for no reason. I quit the next day and threw in my mop. And that was my first and last autopsy.
Savage.
My dad, God rest his soul, owned a small antique store on the Lower East Side of New York. And he specialized in 19th century French bronzes. And they were gorgeous. You know, I learned a lot about art because I stared at them all day long. Now, you may say, oh, what do you know about art? I know a lot about art, believe me. Trust me, I probably know more than the art historian of your choice. So these figures would come in with a brown or black patina, which is the accumulation over the ages. And it was gorgeous, the patina. But the nouveaus who were buying the figures to turn them into lamps wanted them to look like gold, because underneath the patina was the original bronze color. So, okay, all right, Ben, I'll take that, turn it into a lamp, you know, mount the thing, blah, blah, blah. So they'd buy it, and a certain number would be left for the weekend, and I'd have to clean them in the basement, down into the pit, dirty, horrible, dank, huge old wine barrels, a toilet from hell, no mirror on the wall except speckled from the acid that hit the mirror. I'm down there for, I don't know what age, 14, 12, 15, I don't remember, with a toothbrush. There was only one other guy he would hire to do it, this guy named Louis from the Bowery. Nobody else in history would do this. Get rubber gloves up to my elbows, and you would drop these white pellets into water, turn it into a cyanide solution. And then you would take the brush, and you'd rub the figure until the patina came off the bronze. And I'm rubbing it. It would take you an hour to do each one or two. Rub, and you're a kid. You're rubbing, and what you're thinking about is where you're going to go that night. You're going out on a date, or you're going to hang out with your friends, you're going to drag race, whatever. Meanwhile, my face would be blotched. And I'm rubbing and cleaning, and it's like a Dickens basement. So one day, so I go into high school chemistry, and I said to my teacher, I told him what I was doing. I was using cyanide balls. My father had a huge chemical supply. No, it was not used for anything but this. And I said to the teacher, I use these cyanide balls for a cleaning solution. They said, what? So I went, that's poisonous, he said to him. They use cyanide balls at San Quentin to kill people. But he said, don't get worried. There's a sodium cyanide, and then there's a potassium cyanide salt. So I said, really? Oh, this is very much like Abraham slew Isaac. So I went to my dad, and I said, do you know that they use cyanide to kill people at, you know, the gas? He said, yeah, but that's the other one. I'm giving you the correct ion. I said, oh, thanks, Dad. That was close. You know, it was definitely out of the Bible. You got to understand the context of this story. He's like, oh, he put the knife to the throat, but he didn't cut it because God said use potassium cyanide, not sodium cyanide. Now, to this day, I don't know which one kills you. So that's it. Now, if you look back upon it, this is a side note. I swear to God, if you're a doctor listening to this show, or a trained scientist, I want you to think about what I'm going to say. Is it possible that inhaling the fumes that didn't kill you outright in some way mitted against the fatty foods collecting in my arteries? I have a pet theory that in some way, although it blotched my face, it built up my immunity to something. I know it did.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Play the Hawaiian music. Maybe it'll calm me down for a second because I almost got excited. The dog's asleep. Talking with Teddy here instead of Travels with Charlie. Talking with Teddy. Not bad. He likes listening to the show. He didn't want to go to work today. He wanted to stay here with me. He wanted to stay on the couch. He knows tonight after... All right, they got the picture ready with that rotten music. He knows what's coming tonight. After a trip, I don't want to eat out now for a week, so I'll cook at home. And he knows when I cook at home, he eats like a Roman emperor. Whatever I eat, he gets. If I make a potato, he gets the potato. If I make a chicken, he gets the chicken. If I make a bean, he gets the bean. I try to give him more of the beans than the flesh because they got the chips they eat today. Had my first dog had chips, he'd be alive probably another 10 years, but they ate garbage in those days, the dogs of my day. They fed him kennel ration. I have nothing against the product. I think it was ground up horse hooves or something, and it was nothing. You never gave him a grain or a vegetable. In fact, I once tried to feed that dog a vegetable. My father yelled at me, "Don't give him a vegetable. They don't eat it." "What do you mean they don't eat it? We eat it. We're not dogs. They made for meat, only meat. Don't you dare give him a carrot." Well, they like it. "No, don't give him. You'll poison him. He doesn't have the stomach for it." God, the things they didn't know in those days. But I try to slip him a vegetable now and again to keep him. I figured he liked it. A horse eats a carrot. Why couldn't a dog eat a carrot, I figured, or a green bean from the plate that I didn't want? "No, only the meat. The meat. The meat he likes. The meat. To give him heavy, fatty. Well, leftovers, what I leave over, the greasy stuff that even I won't eat, that with the bone give him." 9 years old, dead, a heart attack. Even then, the hot dog even had a heart attack from the kitchen food. I told you, stiff on the rug in Queens. Terrible moment. My mother was crying, and I'm not knocking him. I happen to have had a brother who was sick, and I love him dearly. I would have killed for him, and I wouldn't let anyone hurt him. So don't tell me I'm insensitive. It's usually you rats who never even lived through it who are the most insensitive pigs. But you're quick on the internet like a lynching mob. Da-da-da-da-da. That's all you do. You losers in your undershirts. You bloggers. All you do is sit there like a lynch mob. You're all brave with your keypads. Everyone's no good but you. So after 9 years, even if he was a little vicious and bit me through to the bone, you come down, and you see the creature stiff on the rug, on a green rug, unmoving, and my mother's crying. "What happened? What happened?" "I don't know. He's dead. He's dead." "What do you mean he's dead? Look, look." And she touched his legs. He must have been dead hours because he was already rigid on the rug. "All right, Ma, get away. Get away, Ma. Let me see." And you touch not directly because you're afraid he could be like in a fit and snapped and rip your throat out because he was a vicious dog. You figured maybe he was like knocked out, he had an epileptic attack, whatever. So you don't right away touch the whole body because it could spring into action and kill you. You touch the foot like from a distance with your hand. So if he snaps, you only lose a hand, not like your entire life. I'm just playing with it. No, you did. You touched the foot and it was rigid. It had the feeling when you touched the foot of the dead dog on the pad of the foot. It had the equivalent feeling of like a broom, like a small broom laying there. So what are you going to do? So she called it. The ultimate authority had to be called, yet he was still asleep. It was not yet time to go to work. And he gave the edict like Caesar. "All right, it's finished. It's over. Boom. Call the garbage men." What? That's what they did. There was no pet cemeteries with weeping and crying and cremation and jars that people have. I'm soft-headed, too. I got a jar at the last dog with his picture. The whole thing changes. You go along with it or you wind up crazy altogether. So now I have a box with the dog's ashes in it. I'm sure the ashes in there are not for my dog. I guarantee you they gave it from a leaf they burned somewhere. Those crooks in those crematoria. Like they give it your dog's ashes. Oh, yeah, here's your dog's ashes. Sure. They didn't burn a leaf. They probably got it from the park. From a drunk parkie that set the leaves on fire when he fell over in an alcoholic stupor with a cigarette. And they went, they told the kid, the half-wit from the neighborhood who worked in the crematorium, go get the ashes from the parkie, roll them out of the leaves, the bum there, and get the leaves, bring them in. You're going to set them out in various dishes, the leaves, the burnt leaves, and I've got 100 dishes for you to do, dummy. 100? Yeah, today by noon, dummy. Go get the leaves and bring them and stuff them. And then each one you put the label on. Here lies Teddy, the dog that he loved so dear. Inside is a burnt leaf. But in those days, as I say, the garbage men came and they wore in those days, the garbage men in New York, the sanitation department they call it today, the garbage men, they wore brown suits that were made of a certain fabric that was so hostile. What would you wear if you were in a garbage truck every day? Today they look like Apaches coming off the truck with tomahawks. In those days, even the garbage men wore a uniform. Well, albeit it wasn't great. It wasn't designed by Da Vinci, but I mean by Boss. It wasn't a Boss suit. Boss worked only for Hitler. They made a nice suit for the Nazis. I think they were Boss designs, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, no, yeah, the one with the big shoulders. They did beautiful uniforms in the 30s. Oh, you could die from them. Gorgeous. But today, they don't wear a uniform. Headbands, bandanas, tomahawks in the back of the garbage truck, speaking languages with tattoos coming off their tongues. You know, it's a different world. But at least today they don't throw a dog in a garbage truck. That's the thing I'm trying to get at. Who would do that today? Nobody. That would be dog abuse. I watch that show at night, like Miami Pet Police. They're like saints to me, people in that business. You know, they usually go into like neighbors, like poverty neighborhoods where they abuse animals like it's part of their culture. They always say they don't know whose dog it was. He ran in. I have no idea. The dog is kept with like welts and the fur ripped off, barbed wire around his neck. And the guy comes in. They get him. They figure he's coming back from an episode holding up a 7-Eleven. And they say to him, hey, Jack, is this your dog? No, he just came in here. I ran, jumped the fence. What dog? Oh, no. Never saw him before. Look, Jack, he's got a cut. No, I don't know whose dog. Must be my neighbor's dog. You getting hostile with me? You getting hostile with me? But the guys have a lot of guts in that business with the guns. They take them in. I really admire them today. But you wouldn't, even a guy like that wouldn't throw a dog into a garbage truck. What do they do with them, a guy like that, if one of the dogs finally dies that they used for a pit bull practice? Do they bury them? I don't even know. Do they cook them? What do they do with them? And when they're through with it, do they bury it? Or I really don't know the ins and outs of all of this. I'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I'll always want to because my heart.
It is Rock and Roll Friday. Kill the song. I don't like it. That's all. Welcome to the Savage Nation. There's a couple of stories. It'd be nice to have an easy day today, but it's not going to happen. Monkeys rampage in Indian capital. Just after the Indian deputy mayor toppled to his death fighting off a pack of monkeys, the animals are back on the attack, sparking fresh concerns about the simian menace. One woman was seriously hurt and 24 other people were given first aid after monkeys rampaged through a neighborhood in East Delhi over the weekend. So the monkeys are out of control. Rogue monkeys running into residences. I guess if I go on with the story, I'll be accused of simiophobia. And I'm liable to face a boycott from some monkeys around the globe. And I can't afford that. Because if the monkeys were to boycott my products, there'd be no conservatives left to buy them, I suppose. That reminds me of the monkeys going crazy. You know, many people, everything they turn into cute. Everything's cute. A bear is cute. A monkey's cute. You know, this is such liberal stupidity. Monkeys are dangerous with big teeth. So it reminds me of Louie and the Monkey story, which I told once at most in my tenure on radio. We go back now, ladies and gentlemen, put on your resting cap. We're going to go back in time. We're going back to the Lower East Side of New York. Dad owns a small antiques mart. Little old Michael's cleaning bronzes in the back, and there's Louie the bum from the Bowery, who in those days, he was a drunk. He wasn't a bum. He worked. Dad would have him in on the weekends, and he'd clean the bronzes and whatever he did down there. I loved Louie. Louie was a great guy. But now you got to understand, this guy was a stoned alcoholic of the old school. Skinny like a rail. White guy, skinny like a rail, smoked like unfiltered cigarettes, but one of the nicest guys on earth. See, where's the rubber apron? He's cleaning downstairs. Does the bronzes. Then, of course, I took over because Dad wanted cheap child labor, and where else are you going to get it from his son, you know? So I'm doing the thing. So I got to know Louie over the years, and he taught me various things. Like once we had Louie over to the house. I'll never forget it. I was so proud that my father took this guy who I liked all the way out to Queens and invited him to dinner. I don't know what came over. Maybe it was Thanksgiving or whatever. And Louie had dinner with us at the table, and the guy was surprisingly erudite, and he knew things. And, like, after dinner, we did games, and Louie the drunk showed me how to bend nails. He showed me mind over matter. He took a nail and he showed me that if you put your fingers, blah, 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 and put your mind on it and keep up the pressure, the nail would bend. I was shocked because I was a skinny kid with little hands, and I bent the nail. And he taught me mind over matter, but it was all molecular because you put the heat and the pressure, blah, 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 eventually that nail is going to bend. But I learned in life it's the same thing. It's all willpower, okay? Now there's another element to the story. So Louis is this kind of guy, interesting, but an alcoholic, and this and that. Years go by. He lives alone in Williamsburg. In those days, Williamsburg was like a slum, zero, you know, oilcloth city, leftover apartments from the last century. No one wanted to be there but the poor. So he lives there alone. He's very lonely. He gets a monkey. He wants a monkey. Now, out of the world, nobody in those days had a monkey. Dogs, yes. Cats, yes. No. Who had a monkey in those days? Louis gets a monkey. But Louis don't just get a spider monkey, one of the skinny little monkeys. Louis gets a woolly monkey. Now, woolly monkeys are already strong. They got a chest on them. They got strong hands. And Louie's in love with this monkey. For a couple of months, they're inseparable. Wherever he goes, there's the monkey. And the monkey's on his shoulder and where he's cleaning and he's happy. Now, Louie was the kind of guy that if he went to a bar in the Lower East Side, I remember the name to this day, named Hamill and Corn. Whatever money he made for my father, he'd take 2 minutes later, he'd be in the bar. And he'd throw money in a jukebox, and he would whistle and sing, and he'd buy everyone drinks till he was broke. He'd stumble out in the street. He would get hit by a car, sleep on a Bowery, didn't care, live for the booze, and that was it. But he had a heart of gold. So Louis gets the monkey, finally has someone to fill his empty nights. And as I say, they were inseparable. Well, as time went on, we get a call. Louis's in the hospital. He's dying. What? The monkey went crazy in his apartment, attacked him, and almost ripped him to pieces. And he suffered for 6 months in the hospital. I don't know which hospital, probably Bellevue, because that's where they all wound up. And the monkey went at him in love. You don't know what a monkey's like when it goes crazy. You try to stop an enraged monkey without a weapon. He ripped his neck. He ripped his face. He ripped his arms. He ripped his leg. He ripped his crotch. He ripped his behind. Louis was ripped up pretty bad. And eventually, he took the monkey. I think he grabbed it and threw it out of the window. It just shows you. If he hadn't have done it, he'd be dead today, okay? But a liberal today probably would have tried to talk to the monkey. Louis knew that the instincts had to kick in. It was him or the monkey, and he decided it was better him than the monkey. He didn't consult a liberal book on how to deal with a crazed monkey. He just fought with it and killed it. I think that's what the bottom line is here. But the point is that even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. In his case, he found the monkey. It was probably the right thing for him to do. But it goes back to the story I opened with, which is that the monkeys are rampaging in India, and the rogue monkeys are breaking into houses, including the daughters of the ruling Congress party. They broke into the Indian parliament. Trouble boiled over in late October when the city's deputy mayor fell to his death driving away monkeys from his home. He was on his balcony reading a paper when four monkeys appear, his family says. He waves a stick to scare them away, tumbles over the edge, and boom, he drops dead, falls off the balcony, and dies. So right now you could see that Louis was a pioneer in a way, in a sense that he understood that monkeys were dangerous long before they did in India when they turned into a sacred animal. And that's the Louis and the monkey story on the Savage Nation. You got to admit it wasn't bad. It's nicely entertaining. And that's it. That's the story. The bottom line is don't get a monkey as a pet. They're wild animals.
Savage.
Since I've had my espresso, And since I'm not going to sleep tonight anyway, because I'm sacrificing tonight's sleep for today's show, as I did last night. I've been up, I think, for about 36 hours. No, I slept, but I didn't sleep. It was like a tossed, horrible, you know, the nightmares were daymares in the middle of the night. But there was nowhere to go in there. The problem is I have nothing to do in the middle of the night. What do you do in the middle of the night when you can't sleep? I have answers to that, too. Because there was a period in my life that I was totally insomniac, and I thought I would die from a lack of sleep. And then I read a lot of books on insomnia, and I found out that insomnia can be your best friend. What it means is you don't really need to sleep. You're not tired. Most of us sleep when we don't even have to, incidentally. This is a myth that you have to sleep. It's like a myth like you have to have three meals a day, or that you have to drink eight glasses of water or three cups of milk a day or whatever. You're not tired, so you're not sleeping. The trick is to not lay in bed. I remember reading one book during this period when I couldn't sleep, and it was mainly money worries. It was money worries because of a lot of reasons, whatever. The kids were young, and I was worried about their future and my future, and what am I going to do? And I killed myself, and they won't hire me because I'm a white male, and they're hiring idiots and morons and putting them into jobs they're not qualified for and perverts, which, of course, was 100% true. Just take a look at your universities today, putting what they're doing in the universities outside the science departments, which, of course, unfortunately for them, they can't yet populate with their inferior plants, because either you understand the periodic table of the elements or you don't. You can't quite do what you do in the social sciences. Nevertheless, I'm up, I'm this and that. So I get a book that says more people have died worrying about a lack of sleep than from a lack of sleep. And I forget who wrote the book. And it was like 10 things you could do. Someone's going to write this down, steal it, and make a book out of it, probably. That's okay. I don't really care. Go ahead and do it. And I learned a lot of different techniques. The number one thing was I went out on my deck and looked at the stars. And that's when I started to love stars again after childhood. You see, okay, I'm up. It's dark. The sky is black. The stars are bright. What am I going to do with the time? How about getting out a book that shows me star formations? So there they were. And slowly, you know, and the next one is learn to read, learn to do this, learn to do that. And before long, when you stop worrying about not sleeping, you wind up sleeping again. It's like everything else. You understand that or not? Sure, it's like everything else. You know, there used to be an adage amongst guys that a lot of guys are always hungry for a date for a woman and they couldn't get one. And the guys who did always had the same story to tell, which is that women can tell when you're nervous and you want a woman and they'll avoid you like you have leprosy. That the only guys women want are the ones who don't want them or let's say, are aloof and really don't care. It's a terrible reality. It's the same the other way, too, by the way. You know, you get desperate, the other party can sense it like an animal. Well, how was it put? We pursue that which retreats. Have you heard that one in the dating world? It's pretty much true in the business world as well. We pursue that which retreats. So the best thing to do is retreat, even when you want to pursue, in most cases. It's a terrible rule, but it's like hunting and you ask a hunter. There's only one way to hunt, or there's only a particular few ways to hunt, and none of them consist of rushing right at the animals. But that's neither here nor there. So let's go back to the insomnia before I get too far off the track. There are many other things you can do. And, of course, I learned to use passion flower herbal tea. I was very into the whole story there. And that's a great – wait, hold it. There's my story. Let me tell you how I learned to use passion flower herbal tea and how not only did it give me relief from insomnia, but I then learned to carry this tea around with me all over the world in my travels, and it became a great relaxant on airplanes. I didn't have to drink any alcohol. I didn't need the two little bottles of wine that they used to have in those days. Remember those days they served you wine in those two little bottles that you got, the El Cheapo wine bottles that were on airplanes? Now it's bottled water. Well, anyway, so I heard about a guy, a pharmacist in San Francisco on Ellis Street. He was like an old guy, about 85, 88 at the time. And he was an old timer going way, way back. I don't know what his name was. He was an old Jewish guy named Morris. He was right near the Glide Memorial Church, as a matter of fact, which is a largely African-American church. And I forget the name of the pharmacy. He's since passed on. I go in there because I heard he knew everything about herbal medicine. He was a real pharmacist as opposed to people who were faking it with chlamydia and half mustaches in the health food stores. And I come in and right away I say to him, "Do you have a passion flower herbal tea?" He says to me, "Why, who are you? What do you want?" It was like right out of Brooklyn, and the guy, it was in San Francisco. I said, no, he said, "What, are you an inspector with the FDA? I have nothing. Get out of my store." That's how it started. "I don't have nothing. I have no herbal tea," he says to me. That's all he sold. So I said to him, well, I heard you sell herbal tea. I don't know who you heard from. I have nothing here. I'm a regular drugstore. So I said, calm down. And I had to show him one of my books. He was afraid I was an inspector, in other words. I think he had been busted by the FDA for selling real products that work, called herbal medicine, instead of toxic chemicals that killed and addicted people, called pharmaceuticals. So we got to talk, and he said, what's your problem? I said, I can't sleep. He says, look, mister, you're still wasting your time. He said, go across the street to Joe's Bar and have two shots of scotch and go home. You'll fall asleep. I have nothing for you. Well, eventually he gave me the passion flower herbal tea. I used it. I would brew it every night, and I slept like a baby in the arms of Buddha. This is the Savage Nation.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you.
Shabub, shabub. I want to hear shabub. Shabub, shabub. And I'll go. There we go. That's all I need. Shabub, shabub. Wurlitzer Jukebox. Spring Glen, New York, circa 1954. Long walks on dark roads with the other kids, flashlights, goblins. No fear of Islamofascism, they didn't exist. There was no past, there was no tomorrow, there was only the dark night.
I don't know if it's cloudy or bright.
Couldn't see through the dark of the Catskill Mountains. We touch each other and howl with delight out of fear. And excitement. We get to the candy store with the pinball machine. We play it all night, drinking ice cream sodas. No fear of heart attacks then. None of the parents had gotten sick yet. Everyone was healthy and happy. No one got sick and died. There were no funerals. It was an eternal future. Here we are. Here we are. Here we are. Here we are. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the anti-American movie. Take me out to the failing newspapers. I turn it on. I'm getting sad. I'm getting maudlin. I don't like the feeling. I need an uplifting thing. Play Speedo. That's all. I don't feel good now. I got to go the other way. I'm getting down. I don't want to go down. I felt the elevator. I took the elevator into the basement. Put on Speedo, would you? I got to go up to the 80th floor. That's better. Friday night. There's a party tonight in someone's finished basement. Parents are away. We're going to raid the liquor cabinet. We're going to dance and break the tables. Oh, did I have fun as a kid? What happened to my life? What fun I used to have. God! God, if I could only be 12 again and know what I know. Ooh. I want to hear that last piece, then I'll do my job. Don't worry. One horn piece. Give me a break here. Here we go. We're getting close.
Yes, man, Speedo. He don't ever take it slow. Well, not he up and call me Speedo.
So good. What a cadence. There's a horn piece here. You got to hear this. Right out of St. Louis. Listen to this. He's going to do the horn solo. Here it comes. Oh! Yeah. Listen to this. Right out of East St. Louis. But you got to understand jazz to understand how good this is. I don't care if the guy was ripped on heroin. It doesn't matter to me. What music? I don't care if he was coked out of his board. It doesn't matter to me. What music? All right, turn it off. Now I'm getting carried away. You're too manicky. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Now play At the Hop. That's all. Because I'm going to think now what I want to say next. I'm not sure. Wait, I got to find this. There you go. old favorite, Rock and Roll Friday.
Do the dance sensations that are sweeping the nation at the hop. Let's go.
You ever hear a drum piece like that? Where do these guys go?
Baby,
how come they can't play like this anymore? All right, turn it off. Now I feel too good. So I was watching the Ken Burns documentary on World War II last night, 7-disc set, and I put in the first disc. I'm going to watch one disc a night, I think, for the next week. And they interview a guy in there, they take a few men and follow him through the war, which is astounding. I mean, it's a piece of work that you can't believe. One of them is a gentleman, probably of a Scandinavian descent. I think his name is Arneson from Minnesota. And they're interviewing him now recently. Remember, the man must be 80 years old. And they show him with stills of him when he was a kid, a farm kid. You know, average lanky white boy, hay, farmer, wagon, drugstore, girlfriend kind of guy, church. So Arneson says that he was basically a pacifist in the 30s. You hear this? Now the guy becomes like one of the great fighter pilots of World War II. And there's an amazing subtext in this whole story that I don't know if Ken Burns brings out, but I'm going to bring it out to you now because I studied this 10 years ago. Many of the fighter pilots of World War II grew up hunting small game and medium-sized game in America. In other words, they used guns, unlike the real estate broker to the stars who was found bludgeoned to death in Manhattan, Linda Stein. You know what I'm saying? Now, there's Linda Stein didn't use a gun, and people like her didn't use a gun. People from there didn't use a gun. They're anti-gun. But the boys, like from Minnesota or from Knoxville, Tennessee, or from Pensacola, grew up hunting small game varmints, they call them. And they listen to this. So the pilots that I interviewed years ago, 10 years ago here on this show, they said to me, because we learned how to lead an animal with a rifle, we were able to be good fighter pilots. Now, many of you from New York City and L.A. don't know what lead an animal means. You think it means take a dog on a leash to pee on your neighbor's lawn. No, that's not what lead an animal means. It means that when the animal is running across your field of vision and you want to shoot it, you know, and kill it, you're hunting, you fire in front of the animal because the animal's going to come into the bullet. The bullet doesn't move like it's not like a video game. So he said, because of that, we were good fighter pilots because we knew how to lead the enemy in the ME-109s or the Jap Zeros. You understand this or not? The problem here now is we've had a whole generation of boys deprived the joy and the importance of using guns. You understand what I'm saying to you? We're a nation of lambs. We're a nation of lambs getting ready for the slaughter.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.